Wednesday, the 19th of February. We follow on with answers to oral questions. We commence with question number 141. The questioner is the Honourable Aaron Kinsey.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise how county officers have been able to monitor compliance of their budget, given the disruption in the operation of the entire accounting system?
And for the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
Mr. Speaker, Kelsey Financial went live on the 5th of August 2019 and taking the trading accounting system in place. CSS allows all departments direct access to financial data on a live basis, thereby removing the need to manually reconcile departmental information against information held centrally, which is the case for Indian Tower. Departments were able to maintain their manual workbooks and instructed to do so on the 28th of November 2019 when the Nation government decided to delay the implementation of CSS until the 31st of March 2020. In order to facilitate the preparation of forecast back then, 2019-20, not from the 2020-21. Once we decided to continue using TAP for the preparation of the estimate of total engaged with the receipt of revenue and controlling officers to provide details of receipts and payments made using CSS.
I think I'm waiting for Mr. Chairman to answer, but can I just clarify? I heard him correctly in terms of your ask. I can't remember off to keep the manual record of their expenditure and what it is or not. Is it that they are now, or is there a method or some sort of mitigation system in place whereby those holders will get a report from February showing where they are, or they have to do some sort of internal bookkeeping or control? What is it that they rely on as a backstop
or a contingency measure? There's a bit of instruction to continue to use TAP for this on 28th of November when we paused their life. And those departments have continued to use their vote books, have the information manually as they did have before, and during, many did. Those that didn't, there was an exercise ongoing between themselves, those departments, and Treasury to reconcile in detail, because obviously all the information is on CSS for that period, the intervening period, which is visible to Treasury.
I think that this is a very technical question, but is there a difference between what they told us that it had in the past and the price they lost financial year of the new financial year in terms of speed of access to information? Is there a delay in which both portals will get the information they would need to see whether they are over or on the budget? And even if they're satisfied that both portals have the information they need on a timely basis to be able to monitor against their budget?
The question by guessing, which is that I'm aware that there has been some disruption. So is it as smooth as we'd like it to be? The answer is no. But am I confident that we'll get to where we need to get to? Yes. Question number 142, the Honourable D. Davison.
The Minister of Financial Services is aware the article published in issue number 115, which is also in the press, reporting on the views expressed by the Chairman of JICIA in the context of review.
And to the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Speaker, I can confirm that I am aware of the article published in the reporting on the press.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, raising the House and Parliament the article, which entitled Exodus Begins. And whilst it does say some positive things about the government's actions in this regard, and I quote, it says the government is devoted to doing an extraordinary job in a difficult situation. It also highlights certain aspects, Mr. Speaker, which are concerned. I would be grateful for the Minister's comments in relation to this. And I would quote the following, Mr. Speaker. The government has been difficult on the financing of the Gibraltar, and then some companies, particularly asset management firms, have been dealing with Gibraltar, and some have instructed that minimizing the Gibraltar footprint. So I'd be grateful for the Minister's comments in relation to this and what plan we have in relation to trying to address these issues as best we can.
I think the work that the Chief Minister, Deputy Minister have done in securing the extraordinary and unique facility that our financial services firms will have into the UK is quite incredible when you come and meet people from other countries around the world who are keen to have that sort of access. And it's only been done because it is only doors we immediately after having done the heat map work in the first few months in 2016, determined that 92% of our financial services business was in the UK. As a consequence, the target for delivering what was best for the water was that access we had from the government. Did we know then, as we do now, that there were going to be firms that we need access to the UK? Well, of course we did, and of course we do. And therefore, what has happened between 2016 and today is that those firms that are impacted upon by Brexit and the new access to the single market like the United Kingdom have to make adequate arrangements, alternative arrangements, which of course they have, as they have done indeed in the UK. It would be responsibly explained if they haven't. And consequently, those firms that need to have access to the European Union countries have made alternative arrangements. Some of them are referred to by Mr. Lasry in the article. Some are not, or are unexpected too. So I think to answer the question fully, I would agree with what Mr. Lasry says in terms of the extraordinary job that's been done by the Chief Minister and Deputy Minister in securing this passporting. And I also recognise that the people going to need single market access, which are consequence of Brexit, if you don't like, well, then they have to make the arrangements they have to ensure they want to continue that. Mark about it, that's what we have to do. Stephen, based on your response, did you have any concerns with regards to the possible dwindling presence of these companies in Gibraltar as a result of Brexit? So whilst we may have secured that very important access to the UK market, because the single market access is so important to these companies, and they are very presented with the IMF itself before the session, where they are sort of readjusting their operations, but nevertheless still having a presence in Gibraltar. Do you have a concern that that may not necessarily be the case in the medium to long term future? Mr. Speaker, the word dwindling suggests something is crumbling. There is no dwindling, there is no crumbling. But that has big consequences of Brexit. Of course, they have. This is far from the reality that has impacted some of our businesses. We have 8% of our financial services market. The taxes in the European Union. They can't. So, is there going to be less than there was before? Absolutely. Are we going to have firms in January of next year accessing the European Union today? That's very, very unlikely. So, will there be a rest of our business? Yes. And therefore, what do we have to do? We've got to work twice as hard to ensure that we will get more business in the UK, our natural market, to more than make up for that 8%. And then, what I've told my friend and the public statement to the effect that all the clients will be going to London once a month, every month, targeting law firms, accounting firms, fund managers, insurance firms, all the different business groups, think to go to in business in terms of what we can do for the UK market. And we had the first stuff week last week, which went extremely well, and we will do an extra market and we'll be carrying on all the way because that is the way that we will ensure that we retain that quantum of business that we wish to see here in Gibraltar.
Speaker, just one for clarification, just so I understand where the honourable member is coming from. So he said that 92% of our financial services workers coming from the UK industries, and then he said, then he says 8% is business into the EU. Am I right to assume that he's actually speaking loosely, or 92 or maybe 100, because maybe there's business, financial services business, has been derived from other places in the world, like Switzerland and perhaps the United States and so on. But are these actual figures, or is it speaking loosely?
Not going into his configuration the information that he put into the public domain at the time, immediately after the Brexit referendum, which my other friend referred to, which is the heat mapping work. And that work was about work done in the European Union. So the United Kingdom, in that context, was a member state of the European Union. And because of the survey that we do, we didn't ask people what work they did in Australia or in the United States that would be unaffected by the referendum or the consequences of the referendum. We asked what they did in the European Union. Where in the European Union is your business if it is in the European Union? And that 92:8 is in that context, therefore, entirely about business which originated in the single market. The single market, therefore, then including the United Kingdom, and as we often have heard me say, we enjoyed right of access to the United Kingdom as a market because we were a part of the single market. Rights that other overseas territories and the UK dependencies did not enjoy because they did not go on to form part of the single market because of the choices they made in 72 and the subsequent effects thereof. So that's the reason why the number reaches completion or completeness of 100% because it was all about the whole of the European Union market as it was at that time and will be until the end of this year because of the application of the conditional arrangement in the transition period. Can the Minister clarify so far as the marketing ratio to the United Kingdom in order to market our jurisdiction and invite further work and generate further activity for our economy? Is the government intending on inviting the private sector to go along with the government, partner sector revenue so far as those 6 billion? And if the government is still intending, which industries are there particularly private sector? Great.
At these sessions, if you were to take the private sector here, where we go and see could be 2014, it's important to manage. So what we have done is leave the local firms in the first session of last week to arrange these meetings for us with friends in London. So PwC involved in PwC London, KPMG, Y. That is the nature of the coordination we get from here. PwC wants to come with us to get the money on our direction, but we're not opening up to the rest of the sector. We will be organizing events which will engage the rest of the sector throughout the year, not just once a year as we've done in the past. Question number 143, the onboard to Jonathan.
And therefore, digital and financial services advise the House what he intends to achieve by attending events such as the Blockchain for Your Economics 2020.
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Speaker, we aim to promote the board's position as a leading centre for blockchain business by interacting with that and doing media and other relevant representative individuals. The organisation that arranged the conference. And the speakers included private, public, and political entities.
Mr. Speaker, the full report of the Honourable Member's visit in the Gibraltar Chronicle. I think this question of some effect arises from the answers that he gave us in response to our supplementary. Given that, as you rightly pointed out, most of our business, pretty much all of the business is UK-based. And the effect that Brexit is having on that begs the question, what is the point of going to the centre of Europe in order to fly and drum up business affairs if we don't have single market access? So at that point, that would be grateful if the Honourable Minister could address them as a reply.
Mr. Speaker, the development of our thinking in the GLP format that we introduced in 2017. We engage with the European Parliament. We have a lot of friends there in the blockchain space specifically. And so they have been very useful to us in how our thinking has evolved and how we've got to. And we continue to engage with them. The head of The co-chair of the blockchain unit for New Zealand Parliament is somebody that you know well and who we bounce ideas off and we continue that engagement. But the European Parliament and does this work in the country is not simply EU friends that are there. I mean, the whole world is there. There are friends there from the US, from Asia, because everyone is engaging. What happened on the panel was the MD of IBM Blockchain. You know, these are international organizations who engage with the EU, because the EU actually is quite far behind in terms of blockchain thinking. The amount that they quantify blockchain business being in the EU is 5%. It's 60% in Asia, 20% in the US, and 5% in the EU. And the bulk of that is in London. But a lot of the thinking actually is very useful to be involved in the process. So the idea that we have coming next, we are engaging with the experts in the European Union and some friends that we have there to gather more thinking, more intelligence, more information on the direction that we want to go through. So it's a very useful interaction with all sorts. And we have some very good follow up with the right on it.
Peter, can I ask you to confirm that I think everyone has replied that the intention is to continue with the EU despite the onset of Brexit? And if I may also ask the first supplementary attached to that, because I'm sure we'll be able to answer the first one quite quickly. Would the possible deal change here that the UK negotiation on behalf of the entire UK family continues to do so, really, the EU have an impact then of. Will have an impact on the
Speaker, the meeting, whenever it benefits Walter, will continue at the Kosovo. So if you believe it was something of positive return for our private sector and our economy in the Kosovo, in respect of the trade deal, anything that we can do to enhance and strengthen the current security of resources available to the water firms, the better one for you. Hopefully, yes. Question number 144, the Honourable Dean Davis.
Can the Minister for Financial Services provide an update following the on-site visit by the Manavau Committee of Experts to Gibraltar last year?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Mr. Speaker, I want to question to the questions 145 and 146. Question number 145, the Honourable Minister is MD of Hanoi.
The initial draft of the
Manavau
report shows the vote demonstration systemic failures as a jurisdiction or is government satisfied with the findings of this report?
Question number 146. The Honourable is MD Hassanon.
Can government explain the reason for the delay in publishing the Manavau report? Mr. Speaker, if I may, I'm sure the Honourable Gentleman understands that I think that I can speak for the Honourable Gentleman on my right as well, that I think he's certainly published and put through before the report came out, so it might look a little dated now.
I'm the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. The timing of the report, obviously, what actually is running the government. Government received the final report to send on all the other things on the website. So there is no, I hope you don't have exactly the reference that we haven't put after the questions have arrived. It is totally, tell you about the book. The civil connection to the update following the visit by the Manavau Committee, as well as what the government is satisfied with the findings of the report, by referring on an amendment to the government press release 18th of 2020, dating Wednesday, the 12th of February 2020. The Manavau report was published on Wednesday, the 12th of February 2020. The time of the publication rested entirely with the Manavau Secretariat and its own procedures.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, just for the sake of the record, and we probably understand that the file was questioned within 7 time periods before the meeting of Parliament, and then we were clearly overtaken by events. And if they happen, if we put forward with the fact that public, so in many respects, some of our questions have become irrelevant. But with your, Mr. Speaker's permission, I'd be grateful if you could ask some supplementary things in relation to the report. You mentioned having
the report, when it, the final report that we talked about when it was published. I've only seen it in the and so can he advise the House if he received a draft of the report in advance of the other publication of the final report? Is that something that the government gets to see before the whole of the government and actually is around the side of the to see a final report at the same time of the election? Is that something that you can share with us?
The government, indeed, the entire working group, received draft reports of various stages, and we've had to be able to comment on them, which of course we have, over a quite lengthy period. What happens is that the report is highly confidential, and therefore not to the right side of that working group under any circumstances at all. There have been other jurisdictions that have been scorned by an early publication, and we took the view that we would comply with a request and maintain a confidential in the manner of the request, so that's exactly what we did.
Because I may may also supplement you too. We knew that Moneyvals were conducting their assessment for a while back, and we had sent a plan to fix our anti-money laundering problems. Would the government concede that more could have been done to avoid the results that transpired?
Because we're on a point of order, I don't want to call my other friend Phil here, but it was my question, and maybe I get to complete my supplementary, but then they want to be a member. I hadn't quite finished my supplementary, but I'm going to. Mr. Speaker, I have had an opportunity not to read the entire report. I must confess that it's 50 pages long, and I haven't had an opportunity yet to read it. I have read the key findings, and it was based on the key findings and the government question that I was able to react with the help of the other decision, within an hour after receiving notice that this document had been published. Can I ask the Minister what is in effect in the government's gift that it can do to improve our rating? When I think it's the next report, updating report is going to happen in 2021. It seems that as far as direct state action is concerned, we have passed with flying colours in the sense that it speaks very highly of the legislative framework and work that has been done in relation to that. And for that, I think we need to congratulate the government, and I would say ourselves as a parliament for having passed with good rates. But is there anything else which the government can do, whether presumably by provision of resources, traditionally and entities like that, to improve our rating, or indeed, I would have thought, by educating and fostering education and training in relation to the various topics where the experts who look at us felt that we were lacking and lagging behind it.
Mr. Speaker, I think the question is a good one in the sense that is the more the government can do? I mean, part of the effectiveness test is have we done, have we made enough efforts? To prove a negative, you take it as a better term. And if you don't have sufficient, is it because you haven't put in sufficient resources? Or is it because the people who do it aren't good enough? It's not a reason to go to what we have done. And don't forget, as the press release said, our entry into Moneyvals was without request. This is not a process of touching people out, exploding people. This is a process of ensuring that more and more countries raise standards to fight terrorist financing and money laundering. And so they have a huge amount to say about how well we've done in the limited period of time that we've worked on, which is 2.5 years. To put ourselves in the state that we put ourselves in. But of course, the evaluation is only a period of 4 years when the first 2 years, some of the data that we would have liked to have, we didn't have available to us. So I have absolutely no doubt that moving forward, we will get better and better and still better and better. but we have to recognize that it's such a small jurisdiction. Some of the effective mechanisms that we are asked to meet are difficult because they require international cooperation, international arrest, international confiscation orders, which are not necessarily easy to solve the issues by that. So we have to put in place a remediation program, which in some instances does include some more resources that we've already been collected from the region we have to do. So we need to go into certain limited instances. And in terms of the typical assessment, which we did very well, there are a couple of minor details that we are working on with the drafters to ensure that we bring those fully up to speed too. So if you read the report, you would gather from it that it's actually done very well. But if you look at the scoring on the effectiveness, it doesn't quite paint the same picture, which is unfortunate. But as I said, this is about improving the standards that we have available to us to ensure that we meet the international standards that countries are requiring, expecting we will do our part to ensure that we do.
Mr. Speaker, yes, and I've got a specific question. I just simply to make the comment by the preamble from the very brief research that I've done on their website. It seems that the bar is very, very high. And there are other jurisdictions who have done not particularly well, I think, in the jurisdiction who, you know, which you would expect would have done a lot better. So I think we need to acknowledge that the bar is very high. But he talks about certain limited circumstances where he says that perhaps some of the resources can be applied and some assistance can be provided to the private government. Can we expand on that at all across the whole house, or is it something he'd rather not do at this stage?
I'd rather not go into the detail of the immigration program across the country, but I'm very happy to have a question again with a member and talking through in detail with the lady and talking through the different aspects of what we're doing around doing it. I think it's appropriate at this stage to say a huge thank you to all the public sector authorities and agencies and departments that worked very closely with us. A lot of private sector engagement has also had to be done. They were also assessed. And so my thanks to them. I didn't go all in thank them, but I think it's important now to recognize the work that they've done. We may not have had the result that we'd wanted, but I think we've done extremely well and we'll continue to improve with the support of all the different parties involved.
I might just in a rush of conviviality, which has been broken out. Also, the government thanks to the Honourable Gentleman for the attitude being took in response to the government's efforts in this consultation, because we thought on this side of the House that it was responsible and it was measured. We don't often react to each other in that way, but I think it was clear that the government here has led in submitting to the effort to this assessment, because it was right that we should understand what and all where we were doing well and where we have to improve, and that we should be open about that when the time came. And indeed, we are beginning to know we were congratulated for our legislation. Others who might worry that the fact that there was something in there were later criticized for not even having their legislation in place. So this is something that should not be an area of partisan dispute between us. And Honourable Gentleman approach his response to our questions and the publication in a way that I think is commendable. And as I would have written to tell him if I thought it was not, I thought it was right to be right and tell him the right thing.
Do you want to do anything?
I think most of us are still scrolling through the 250 pages and trying to extrapolate some clarity over it. One of the things that I seem to see repeatedly is that the report shows many discrepancies between technical competencies and their execution. And it's a question I would put to government. Why are there so many discrepancies? Why are we considering that the report has come out in flying colours, as many members of Parliament are saying, across the floor, when at the same time there are many concerns that come out of this report in general?
Mr. Speaker, I think the number of people is a little bit harsh and unfair on the sterling work that we put into this by several different people from all our police, customs, and logistics, and indeed the private sector. I don't understand what you mean by discrepancy. I think that there's no question, and it's recognized in our history, that there's no work to be done. You accept that. But I don't understand what the lady means by technical discrepancies. There are issues that we need to do more with. We accept that. We say so in our questions. And the intention and desire of this work is to get better. So I don't believe it's appropriate to criticize where we have room for improvement because we acknowledge what we do.
Sometime with the minister and in due course to propose some questions in the spirit, in the constructive spirit before forming a public opinion. Thank you.
Is it just one question so far as a response to the minister's question relating to the resources? I specifically asked the minister in relation to what the government intends on doing to resolve the prosecuting authority in respect to the criticism that was based in my about the administration. Is there any intention to include that resource specifically within the criticism of the family report?
Mr. Speaker, that is part of the remediation that we are discussing with the police, with the GLO, with the customs, in terms of that we have now identified what each of the departments believes it requires to do within the time period to remediate, and those are the discussions we will be having with the Chief Minister very shortly to conclude.
It's very, very short complimentary. When we apply to join money vow, we require the resolution of the Council of Europe. How will this work as first practice? Is money vow, forgive me if I don't know the answer to this, as I said, is money vow a standalone organisation, or is it come under the European umbrella in this case what happens post practice?
The understanding is that MoneyVal has members from across the world, not just the European Union, obviously. Although it is a unit which is managed from the Council of Europe, it also implements FATF standards, which is where the evaluation really comes from. So it's not solely the European Union institution. There are other ECB and FATF overall. They work together to deliver some of these issues. We now move back to question number 131, and the questioner is the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state how many meetings of the Ethical Council for Health Studies users have been conducted since it was established, and what was the date of the last meeting?
Can we take the Honourable Minister for Health and Care?
The Speaker, the Ethical Council for Health Services users have held 7 meetings. The last meeting was held on the 3rd of April 2019.
There's no reason why a significant period of time, in my view, has passed since the April date of 2019, where the Council has not met. And I preface that, of course, that it's an important organisation which combines many health organisations in our community. And I'm just wondering why it's been so long since they have that down to it. Is it just diaries or is it something else? We don't know. Great.
Speaker, I need to say that this actual council is not something that's statutory and involved in your committee. This is something that's looked at by the previous Minister of Health in an attempt to try to consolidate all the different requests for meetings from the different associations and charities and organisations who request meetings to carry this task or contribute to as to what work they can find, where they can find improvements in the service. In the meantime, my office has been open to all those same organizations to see on a one-to-one basis how we Cabinet Affairs Minister, and I've read very few of what I think about the request for the meeting. It's something that I wasn't entirely aware of, and because it wasn't something that was constituted, it was something which was between the Minister at the time and the Business Association, and it was shared by the government itself on a few occasions, and also by the primary lead, the lead in the primary care centre. My intention is to actually hold on this meeting to see exactly the benefits, and I have heard that it can be beneficial. I mean, it gives the MOLA a platform to be able to discuss the common issues. It doesn't give them necessarily a good platform to discuss their separate issues. The organization have their own things that they want to mention for that. The intention is that I will be arranging one of the things that we see the relevance to. I don't think that it is anything that can win.
Question number 132, the Honourable Ms. Kennedy Hassan Mellon.
Does government have enough staff to man the dispensaries during regular opening hours in the case of staff being off sick?
Question for the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
As the Health Department, if staff are absent for any reason, then all efforts are made to provide cover by withdrawing other staff members in order to continue with operational services.
Mr. Speaker, the reason why I asked this question, I have to declare an interest, was because I actually went to the stores on the 29th of January, actually. And there was a poster that said pharmacy stores closed today due to staff sickness. Sorry for any inconveniences they caused. So my concern was that what is the impact on the patient and when the member staff are sick and the stores closed, and I know that I think they only open a couple of days a week anyway, how does this affect the quality of care on the patient? And what recourse is there for a patient who would need medication or equipment and find himself or herself with a closed door?
There was an issue on that particular day, but that issue has not happened as far as I'm aware in the past or ever since. But there was an issue that day when there were people off sick and they need to go. So I will mention the dispensary stores are there. They do with the general public only a very few on the few items, for example, just to give you the example, for delivery of soma bags and leg bags. So generally, they supply the wards and the clinics. So if there is a need for medication or items, they have access to the store to be required. But the item is that, I mean, other than unforeseen circumstances, and there has been, as far as I'm aware, just one single occasion, and that was the one that the young lady mentioned. But other than that, nothing has been reported to me that affects the care of patients in any of these situations.
Mr. Speaker, I really don't want to get pedantic, but unfortunately, I'm always the one who comes up with personal issues because a month ago, I brought up the issue of cows and how there wasn't staff in cows, and I was told that they must have gone on a toilet break, and now it seems to be the only day that they were off. And, it seems like a recurring issue that I'm always bringing up the one off, and I would put it respectfully to the Honourable Gentleman that there seems to be an issue with lack of staff, and perhaps the government should just face it and ensure to plug the holes for the benefit of the patient and the user.
The speaker of the government, there is a huge increase in the amount of staff generally in the UK. There are times, unfortunately, that we have issues, and we can't for one moment expect that people won't go sick, that people won't be on toilet books. I can't see it doesn't happen. I mean, I just cannot say. I think we are really, really unlucky, or very lucky in that respect, to be doing the right thing in time.
Question number 143, the Honourable Ms. M. Dean is unknown.
Does the government have plans to fund and provide a cardiac cath lab at the Guildhall?
Answer the Honourable Ms. Dean is unknown. Thank you.
If I ask this question together with question 134.
Question number 134, the Honourable Ms. M. Dean is unknown.
Does government have plans to increase funding to provide a specialist cardiac centre for the Guildhall?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
We see that the government is committed to providing a specialist cardiac centre incorporating a cardiac capital laboratory to perform emergency angiograms and cardiac stenting for patients having suffered heart attacks and or angina. This is related by our newly appointed interventional cardiologist.
Honourable Minister, have a planned delivery date for this project?
Number 145, the Honourable Ms. M. Dean is unknown.
Does government have plans to fund and provide an MRI machine for the GHO?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
We see that the government is at present exploring all possible options for provision of MRI services in the GHO.
Mr. Speaker, when the Honourable Gentleman says that they are exploring possibilities, is it something that they want to get done, or is it a possible acquisition? Because, of course, I think it makes a difference to patients effectively, time-sensitive, crucial issues, the drive to Malaga, meaning Salvador, and I totally acknowledge the good intentions of government. government and the Northern Harbour before because we simply haven't and we're trying to improve. But obviously, because it is such a life or death thing, I'd like to know how much of a priority this is going to be for government and for the government budget.
Mr. Speaker, just to correct the unbelievable, the process for claiming in my account for this was here and not Malaga. This is actually a manifesto for victims where we said that we would bring MRI home to the data. Now, what we are looking at is see which is the best way, the most effective way, to bring MRI to the data because obviously an MRI diagnostic MRI diagnostic equipment is extremely expensive. There's a lot of different types of MRI machines, different brands. So we are exploring all options and see where it's best suited and where the machine and the equipment is best placed. So that is why I'm saying MRI is coming home, but we have at the moment and then in fact we're not sure as to where and what form it takes.
Question number 136. The envelope is pending at the moment.
How many consultants have we had working in urology within the GHA since last April 2019?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, I'll ask a question to give you a question. Is 137 to 130?
Question number 137, the envelope is pending at the moment.
How many urology consultant posts exist within the GHA and how many are vacant?
Question number 138.
How many nights a week is there no local on-call urology consultant cover in the GHA?
Question number 139, the cover was ending as unknown.
Which hospital outside of Gibraltar is the main benefactor of our referrals for urology-related services in the last 2 years?
Question number 140, the cover was ending as unknown. To the Honourable Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, the GHA has had 8 consultants working in urology since April 2019. 2 consultants in urology exist within the GHA, both of which are currently vacant. However, this service is covered by local consultants. There has never been a dedicated on-call urology service at the GHA. All cases requiring urgent treatment after hours are seen by the surgical consultants who offer on-call services. The consultant urologist forms part of this team and is on-call on a 1-in-3-week basis. The main centre for external urology related services has been Genesis Care, and the total cost of urology services in Spain for 2019 was £252,524. And 17
cents. Mr. Speaker, the reason why I've asked you questions is because I wonder whether the Minister is aware that localized issues, an example being from what I've been told, things like particular porcelain, for example, are often being asked to be treated by general consultants who don't have a speciality and don't feel comfortable trying to resolve such a specialized medical issue, which is, of course, a urological one. And from what I understand, when a general consultant doesn't want to treat it for fear of not getting it right, the patient has to be rushed to Spain, and the delay in time can very well result in testicular loss. So this is one example of the danger of not having a specialist urologist at hand, which is my understanding. And in light of this reality, would the government agree that we are in need of a round-the-clock urology cover consultant and would it be minded to have plans to provide this cover? And I don't have an interest.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not an expert listening to people talking, to be able to know whether it is treated by the urologist or not. Okay? That there is a urologist available. It might not be at that very moment in time. I mean, if you appear at a meeting with your testicles, at the same time, you have to wait until the next study to be seen. I mean, it's not that we don't have the urologists. We have the urologists, and at the moment they've been covered by locum urologists. They have a surgery right at the moment. But that's a temporary measure. But again, as far as, you know, again, whether there could be instances of leave and there was an unfortunate case of particular forces that needed to be referred to Spain. I mean, that again can happen, but I have no evidence of that. But the service is being covered at present.
As a speaker, why have those two posts that exist not been filled in the last however many months?
There was a few reasons why we don't have to fill the process yet. We've already engaged and agreed to employ a new consultant, and when you employ a new consultant, they can't just, you know, jump in the train and come over to the boat, and you need to give a certain amount of time and inform the employees. And also, we have one consultant that will be starting, I think it was in May. In the interim period, in March, there will be more interviews for the second urologist. Now, we had a urologist in Bogota, and unfortunately, that person had to leave to Bogota for family reasons. So we found ourselves in a situation where we didn't want to lose his services. I tried questioning see whether he'd be prepared to stay on a bit longer and see if he could. That gives a gap, unfortunately, with specific circumstances, then we have to leave. So, in the interim, I think we've covered adequately, and the process continues to make sure that by in months to come, we will have a full complement of three roads within the UK.
Urologist since April 2019, according to the minister. Is the minister aware that this turns out to be a critical issue for both patients and doctors, in the sense that doctors have felt burnt out, many having to take over patients that were not theirs, understand the cases, the continuity of care has been weak because of the turnover, and there is a big impact on the patient as well as on the doctors who have had to take these cases and are feeling burnt out and uncomfortable with the cases that they've had to take over. Is the minister aware and concerned by this lack of continuity, by this burnout, and is it therefore making sure that this turns out to be a priority in terms of appointing new urologists who will have comfortable enough conditions that they will stay and not
leave
as often as
it seems. Mr. Speaker, burnout is a term that the only lady is using. I have not heard anything at all that seems to suggest that the words are burnt out. In fact, the gentleman, the words who was so well liked in the daughter, left because he did not want to leave, he was extremely happy. He left for personal reasons. Family reasons, and there have been other issues, you know, with the world. And the moment that you have on two posts one is missing, then you have a quite changeover of locums to try to cover those two posts. So, you know, they have been covered short term because, you know, we have been taking work that we would employ someone, you know, substantive. So that is why there has been a changeover. And not only that, when you have one road is also entitled to annual leave, even perhaps extended to the other hand, especially about the sick leave, but definitely annual leave, then it's important to have some sort of cover, and this is what has been done on an occasion. The guidelines come from the hospital that we work with as part of the research.
We now go to question 147. The questioner is the Honourable E.J. Hagan.
It is big that the government informed the House, who has been engaged to organise the 2020 which is called the pageant, and is that contract awarded if as a result of the tender basis.
I'm for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Sustainability and Climate Change.
The Gibraltar Cultural Services is the immediate success of the cultural agency which was contracted by the community government to run cultural services in Gibraltar, will not be tendering for the organization of the 2020 Miss Gibraltar Pageant. GCS will organize the event itself.
And the speaker is GCS, then subcontracting others to take part in actually producing this show, such as the Minister says, has now become very popular.
I think the GPS has a large amount of expertise available. Some will be subcontracted to different local entities, but the main organization and so on will be done by GPS itself.
Question number 148, the Honourable E.J.
Can I ask the Minister, is the organisation of this pageant included within their normal contractual terms, or they award GCS receive additional payment for organising the support?
No, I think that's included.
Question number 148, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
The Canada government confirmed that it has commenced consultation with stakeholders in respect to electric vehicle charging points and when it is expected to report to the House on the outcome of that consultation.
I'm from the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Sustainability and Climate Change.
The government put out a call for expressions of interest following which a number of suppliers were identified. Potential sites have also been identified and discussions have been held with the suppliers with a view to raising these out.
I'm grateful for the answer, and I think it answers the question in relation to the expressions of interest, but I believe that the GCS manifesto presented to the Electric Thomas consultation with stakeholders, I specifically asked about that rather than expressing the interest in the wanting a job per se. I was wondering what steps the government has taken to the actual public in relation to electric charging points.
Mr. Speaker, at the moment, other than being always available to hear comments, and having had discussions recently with environmental NGOs, it was only last week I met, as I often do with the ESC, and we discussed that as well as a range of other items. We have also had discussions with some of the suppliers of vehicles, so we know what the industry thinks about this. So yes, there have been discussions on this, and they will be ongoing as we roll out the program. Obviously, we have discussions with my friend and colleague and his Ministry for Traffic and Transport will also continue.
Question number 149, the Honourable Kerry Fabelli.
Mr. Speaker, what were the contracted services currently on the page 44.5A of the approved estimates which were expected to cost $2.65 million in financial year 2019-20, breaking down the contracts by contractor and cost is more than one?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Sustainability and Climate Change.
Mr. Speaker, we have a services which is a result of arrangement entered into with its contractor, the cultural agency, created by the party of the Honourable Member now leads, and provided by the Board of Cultural Services.
So that is a wide institute with one contractual situation. Is that how I've understood most of any member? And if so, what are the services providers coming in? Can you just eliminate that?
Minister, does he think that as a foreseeable objective might be convenient to do it?
as a dog park or a dog simulator facility, as well as an informal facility that was enjoyed at nearby Lafayette.
The building is designed as a dog park proper.
I can't imagine you didn't have a time frame in which you might become available.
We read that little day, promenade, are progressing and need to be updated. We are hoping that it will be ready before the summer. That is the plan.
Question number 152, the Honourable E.J. Hill.
To the end of the relevant question number W23 of 2019 and number W11 of 2020, can government provide details of any legal proceedings it is currently pursuing in respect of debtors who are failing to make repayments?
I will say the Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Courts.
Because there are no legal proceedings currently taking place in respect of collective debt. In the speaker, I note that in the length of a larger tool to move question 23, some hunters are quite new. I feel the debt to the epidemic year 2019-2020 with no repayment plans in place. One, for example, is over a £20,000 mark. There's an hour being broken in the year of 15,000, an hour from the year before 15,000. So there are some that owe substantial sums of money, and some, unfortunately, even go back. A lot of figures have been not seen as big as that, but some go back to the finance or the pandemic year, 1890. That is not being unfair to minister that those who have entered into payment agreements and are hopefully paying according to what they agreed upon, could end up meeting their contractual obligation to win better than money, while others are not being paid up, or at least no legal decisions are being taken, and yet the system does not seem to be fair away from its right towards. It's a thing that's certainly not the case that these people are not being paid up, which is a totally different thing to whether legal proceedings are afoot or not. And the other member has a list which goes back to some historical data, which I'm sure the other member will understand the difference between recovering the fully historical debt. But in respect of the more recent debt going back 10 or 12 years, from the list that the other member has, the vast majority of those have repayment agreements and are actually paying or I counted roughly going back 10 to 12 years, about 130 debtors, of which over 100 seem to have agreements and are paying regularly. The other member refers to recent debt from the year 1920 and some of the amounts and asked whether it's unfair that they should not pay when others do pay. It is certainly our intention that everybody that is a debtor should pay. Should be case. But there is a process. The process, as the Honourable Member will know from the time of the Department of Education, starts at the Department of Education with contact and chasing the individual, seeking a repayment plan and an agreement for that person to pay. If that doesn't happen for whatever reason, because the person is not cooperative or can't be contacted, the matter will eventually be referred to the central area unit of the government that deals with not just these debts, but other debts owed to the government. And there is a mechanism in place whereby emails or letters will be sent and repayment plans will be sought to be put in place. Eventually, there will come a time when consideration may have to be given to the possibility of legal proceedings, and those that what happens and what members will expect to happen is that pre-action letters will be sent giving people a certain amount of time in order to come up either with the payment or an agreement to pay. I can reassure the Honourable Member that it is certainly our intention that everybody should pay or have an agreement to pay. It is certainly wrong agree entirely with the sentiments expressed by the honourable member that if somebody owes £15,000 or £20,000, and somebody else owes £10,000 or £12,000 and is repaid faithfully, that somebody else who owes a similar amount for a greater amount would get away with not paying. So every effort will certainly be made. But the ones in particular that the honourable member refers to are the most recent debts. I do not have specific details on each and every debt, but I can assure the honourable member that every effort will be made so the debts are repaid.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the reassurance in a minute that we're facing the people personally count on my support. Not just as a next member of our organization, but certainly as someone, as a member of the parliament, someone who would like to see fairness being introduced. And I can give him some full support in the same way that the Ministry for Housing has to take certain actions in respect of those who owe rent and so on. That's something we can see, forgotten to consider in library. At this point, we're saying we'll take a long term into mind to do that. I leave that for a future occasion meeting, or perhaps you write the answer the Minister gave me, was quite comprehensive, and it's fair to although, rightly so, he doesn't identify the scheme of justice number. Because it doesn't say that involves one as an educator can get, because of course, you know, some are small debts and some medicines or something tend to be quite a high cost as well. But I think the whole thing is not directly, it may be from me point of view, the speaker's here and take that. And I also think that the speaker, I think one of my colleagues would like to refer that for supplementary.
Just one question, if I may. In relation to the Minister's answer, hasn't it long been the government's policy that with regards to students that are unable to meet those claims because of either mental health or physical health issues that have led to leaving higher education settings in the United States or elsewhere, the government has taken the view that those debts is an absolute waived on the interest of those particular students given that they have demonstrated the physical and mental health concerns? But obviously, after a rigorous process by the government to establish that is in fact the case.
It is not the case that those debts are waived. The case is that those amounts simply don't become debts. They're not considered debts. So the amount that in the list that I have previously provided the honourable member does not include the circumstances which the honourable member describes. And those are specific categories of reasons. In the contract between the government and the students, which is backed up by Gareth Ward, usually will have certain provisions as to the payment in the event that the student does not finish the course, complete the course. And definitely in the case where there are medical reasons, mental health or physical health problems, provided that is supported by medical evidence, then the view will be taken that if it is medically justified for the students to have withdrawn from the course and not proceeded with the course, not completed the course, then those payments which have been made to the students are not considered amounts which ought to be repaid to the Department of Education. They are therefore not considered to be debt. We do not seek to enter into any kind of agreement, and certainly we do not refer those to the Central Review Unit. So the ones that we have been discussing with the Honourable Mr. Reyes do not fall into that category. That's a totally different area which do not arise in the debt in the first place.
Question number 153, the Honourable E.J. Reyes.
Can the Minister for Education state how many pupils have been excluded and or suspended from school since the answer provided to question number W12 of 2020, indicating the number of separate incidents involved which resulted in these pupils being suspended and or excluded, together with details of any education provided during the period of non-attendance at school?
Answer Rob, the Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities, Transport.
Speaker, 15 children involving 8 incidents have been excluded from school since the answer to question W12 of 2020. All of these exclusions are for a short term, during which the pupils are allocated homework so that they can keep up to date with their work.
talking of days, sometimes 2 or 3 days, the maximum excuse in this pattern is 10 days. So we are talking of literally a very short period.
I think you said the maximum suspension of temporary being protected for 10 days for these cases. So I think it's a helpful sort of like a general guideline or threshold of what would be the length of time of exclusion for students, whereby then the education authorities would have to begin on providing alternative education. Because, you know, 10 days is basically 2 weeks, and although it's not desirable for the pupil to miss school for 10 days, the minister has clarified that they're giving certain homework and so on. And I know most teachers will then take it up after the semester. But doesn't have as a general guideline issue to school to say anyone a school or a particular period of time, let's take on some other type of education program. Because there isn't any particular amount of time, which is a definite amount of time whereby a different protocol kicks in. What happens when these incidents occur and the head teacher decides to exclude the pupil pursuant to the behavior policy that the school has? The matter is then referred to the director of education, the faculty of education, to report the incident of the matter to the director of education within 3 days. The director will then consider, probably with the assistance of education advisors, the length of time, the circumstances, and what needs there is for educational provision. And that will be arranged by the Department of Education itself rather than the school. As I indicated, I don't have any specific length of time that would kick in, but those would be decided on an individual case by case basis by the director of education.
Question number 154, the Honourable E.J. Payne.
Sorry, the speaker.
Can the Minister of Education inform this House what digital screeners are currently in place in schools to check if pupils are dyslexic, and what improvements are envisaged as a consequence of government recently signed pledge with the results of dyslexia support?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Force.
It is a special education needs order for the school to assess children who may demonstrate dyslexic tendencies. This is done using an assessment tool known as a dyslexia portfolio. If this assessment identifies any areas of concern, the children are then referred on to the education psychology team for further action. The Department of Education has also acquired a license to Lucid Rapid. This is a digital screener designed to screen children for dyslexic tendencies before they undergo the more in-depth assessment provided by the dyslexia portfolio. This screener has an assured status issued by the Business Dyslexia Association. The team of the Department of Education are now planning for its implementation in four local schools in line with a commitment made by the Majesty's Government of Gibraltar when signing made by the dyslexia pledge. Additionally, all teachers and learning support assistants will be embarking on dyslexia awareness training as part of the made by the dyslexia pledge. This training will be rolled out to school shortly, and we envisage that it will be completed before the end of this academic year.
Thank you, Speaker. I'm glad to hear that last part of the answer for the training of the different trainings related to teachers. But the most often fails to LSM undergoing that. Is it not a case something you think that because it's more of a question of demand, like many LSMs tend to be, rather than substantive employment, you know, tend to be like short term or 1 year contracts and so on, would this necessarily not mean that they're excluded from these training programs as LSMs? Because it's only been those maybe short term children, they end up doing a number of years at the end of the day. They're not always paying, for example, to in-service days and so on at the school proper, because they're paid on a daily basis. I just want to make sure that the LSAs and supply contracts are not excluded from this,
would then benefit the same things, and above all, the people who want to benefit of their improved political system. Because especially the case that veterans learning support assistance are part of the complement of the Department of Education as much as teachers are part of the complement. Where there are additional needs that are identified, any supply of an MSA is built in the same way as supply teachers are used whenever there are needs. In some cases, the teachers for supply of an MSA, they're given a contract for a certain period, sometimes up to a year, the whole academic year. I do envision that everybody that is engaged in teaching and for learning support assistance this year, whether as part of the complement or supply work, will be part of the training that it will be well done. This is something that we would want to see everybody involved in children's education. And I'm glad the Honourable Member has mentioned specifically the case of learning support assistance, and I've mentioned specifically that they'll be three parts of the rollout of the training. They will be the ones that will be dealing with children maybe on a one-to-one basis, and sometimes they may be the first to notice that there is an issue that needs to be referred to teachers and then possibly for further assessment, which is currently done. And there are assessments, as I explained, which are done using the assessment portfolio whenever a child demonstrates any kind of dyslexic tendency. So that happens, and certainly learning support assistance, special needs learning support assistance, are very much at the forefront of all of this and are an important part in the portfolio.
Question number 155, the Honourable Arlen Clinton.
Can the government advise what the plan was for the old Bishop of Stowe School at South Aston once the Technical College has vacated the site?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Board.
Because the government is currently considering all options in respect of the site currently occupied by the Gibraltar College.
Speaker, grateful to the Minister. I want to find out whether any consideration has been given to moving St Mary's School to that site rather than moving it to a new site.
No, Mr. Speaker, the system that was made in respect of St Mary's is something which I believe I explained to you. So we have previously, and we have discussed in this Parliament, that St Mary's will be moving to the new site in town later today.
Can you advise whether it is against intention to retain the building as a school? And if it's no longer feasible to use as a school, can the Minister advise that?
Government is currently considering all options in respect to that site.
Speaker, clearly, if it is currently used as an educational facility, and as far as I'm aware, unless the Minister can advise otherwise, is no structural problem in the building, surely it is still being used as a school, and therefore St Mary's could be relocated there. But the Minister has told the House that they have not even considered that option.
Mr. Speaker, I have not said that we have not considered that option. I have said that we have made a decision in respect of St Mary's. For my part, I do not consider that particular building to be suitable for St Mary's. We're talking about smaller children than those that have previously occupied that building and those who currently occupy that building. What the use of the building will be and whether it will have an educational function, that's a matter for the government to consider and decide on in the future.
Can you all minister just clarify the last answer? I went to about in that building and I was 8 years old. That's about the same age as some of the people in the same age. So why isn't that building suitable for a school? It's been a school for many, many years, for decades.
Good. The pupil didn't know, and I imagine that the older member went to that school as Bishop Pastore, and that is an upper primary school, or we used to call it middle school. St. Mary's is a lower primary, having children as young as five, including the next school. As I said, the government is still considering all options in respect of that particular site, but if the decision has been taken in respect of St. Mary's, and that is that St. Mary's will lead to an exact and some length, those are the plans that we're working to.
But wouldn't it have made logical financial sense to consider the possible relocation of St. Mary's to this site, which is barely 150 metres away from the intended new site, rather than spending taxpayers' money on a St. Mary's school and a new St. Mary's school?
Because it's a matter that we considered before the last election. We set up our plans in the election, we set out what the most important thing to be, and we have been elected on that ticket.
Question number one. Not just one final question.
I see, this point is really bad. As I understood what you suggested, it's better options for the site that make more financial sense, meaning you're talking about the digital show, which is also part of what we call the digital show, like those of us who went to the digital show when we were there. Is there government's presently considering funds which are non-educational for that site? And if so, what are they? And what are its contemplated ideas for that site?
Mr. Speaker, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to the answer, the first answer that was given by the Minister, which includes what he has said. He said we're considering all options for that site. That means, Mr. Speaker, that we are considering options well beyond education. Options which, as all the gentlemen have just been told, include better financial opportunities for the government. But indeed, Mr. Speaker, this is not just about the government. This is about the choice that people made at the general election. They were presented with different options, and one of the options they were presented with was a new St. Mary's school at my end. And as all the gentlemen know, this is the option that the people of Gibraltar chose. They've seen the plan, and they've made their choice. And the government is considering different options for what we call the particular school site, which we call the current site of the College of Further Education, with different proposals for where the College of Further Education will go. We have been elected, Mr. Speaker, by people who have seen these options and selected them to give effect to those options, Mr. Speaker, which we think are the best financially viable options for taxpayers and the best options for our children. Mr. Speaker, with respect, that's not the answer to the question I asked. I asked the question of what are those plans that they are contemplating? What are they contemplating to this? So I asked again, what are those plans? And with all due respect that you've answered, and if you convert it, as it does often, into a who won the election answer, but that none of the contemplated plans for the Bishop of Bill site, where really anybody manifested. So perhaps you can share with me the answer to the question that I asked, which is what are the plans that have been contemplated for the Bishop of Bill site? I don't think that the Honourable Gentleman has understood the answer that I have already given, and that the Minister has given on a number of occasions. It's not about converting the answer into
is who won the election answer. Who won the election is obvious because we're sitting there and we're sitting here. It's about the election, the selection that people made after the election. And the line of questioning was about why St. Mary, Mr. Speaker, would not go to what he likes to refer to as the old Bishop of Charles site. We now want to take us to what is going to happen to this site, Mr. Speaker, so that takes us back to the first answer. St. Mary is not going to Bishop of Charles because the public at the general election selected that St. Mary should go where they selected it to go. And as to the old Bishop of Charles site, as he likes to call it, we are considering a number of different options. Why am I not telling you which of the many options we are considering? We are considering, well, for simple reasons, because the other ones in government, considering them. When we're ready to make an announcement about the ones that we have selected, or the options we want to pursue, we can make an announcement. Because it's bigger. If there's one piece of advice I'm going to take from the Honourable Mr. Clinton, which is not to make an announcement until the ink is dry on the paper. Which is something he said, when I forget which of the flocks was in charge, it might even have been Mr. Clinton himself. When the electorate was talking over one electorate, and one electorate makes this faced with this very long manifesto, and our very long manifesto,
for the past 9 years.
and the results of general elections suggest that the public disagree with them on what the new location for St. Mary's should be and on who makes questionable financial decisions. But I do recommend to him, Mr. Speaker, that he should find some quick and early inoculation to the infection of the idea that manifestos are just witnesses. We don't continue to be so. But I will, of course, remind him in future, if you ever have a reason to depart from a particular manifesto commitment, that he will be able to tell me, according to his logic, that I'm letting people down because I'll tell him that we appear to have not enough manifesto, that people may not have voted for that, and I may have simply have voted in the last. I was not suggesting that manifestos are like this. What I was suggesting is that people make the decision in the round, and that there may have been some people who said, I'm going to vote in this election only because of the issue of Mary. The Mary, this is so important to me that the Mary, this is the one I'm going to vote for. So, generally speaking, that probably would not have manifested itself in the thinking of people. And what I'm saying to the humble member, in his long-winded way, he doesn't really answer the question. That the issue of the decision of St. Mary's has been driven by questionable economics and special interests rather than the interests of the people of Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, I thought that's what he wanted to say. He is, of course, entirely wrong. He is a fool, Mr. Speaker, who wants to suggest that there are questionable interests simply because he thinks in that way he might be able to garner some support for what is obviously a snagging political career. I'm very sorry, Mr. Speaker, but he thinks that he has to question the integrity of people who come to work every day to do their best for this community in order to try and achieve some advantage. In that respect, the virus that he is getting, Mr. Speaker, seems to come to him not from his former leader, then his political opponent. It seems to come from along his benches, Mr. Speaker, where there is one who thinks that the only way that he is able to garner support for himself is by casting aspersions on others. Mr. Speaker, he might be wise to look at what the electorate has done in that respect, because one of the people who most looked support in the past general election has been exactly that person. The person who thinks that the politics of casting aspersions is the constructive politics that this community needs. I know him well enough, Mr. Speaker, to know that he was not like that when he first sat on those benches opposite me some months ago. But I very little hope for him is in these short periods of time, he's already become that which he said he was not. In other words, a pastor of a person for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Whether it's for the people who voted specifically for the St. Mary's Project, whether it's for the people who voted in the round for us, or whether it's for those who chose us for any other reason, Mr. Speaker, we're going to pursue the program for government that we have already persuaded people. It is by far the best program for government for the next 4 years. We're going to pursue it honestly, we're going to pursue it diligently, and if you have the ability to prove that anything financially questionable has gone on, he should say so, Mr. Speaker. I know he doesn't, because nothing financially questionable has gone on. We're making the right decisions for the community, for education, for the finance and public finances of this community, and we're doing so entirely properly every time. And every time that he suggested the opposite, in the short time that he's been the leader of the GOP, he's ended up with an ostrich egg on his face. I'm not surprised. Mr. Speaker, just on a point of order, could I invite the Honourable Chief Minister to withdraw? I think I heard him correctly. The Minister of Logic is fool made of, in relation to my language, and honourable friend. I'm inviting just for the sake of the record, for the extent of the time that I wanted to finish, I could have changed on it, but I didn't. I'm inviting to withdraw that, release of that particular adjective. I'm afraid that the Honourable Gentleman who made an allegation, which is a foolish one, and the person who makes an allegation, which is a foolish one, can only be described as a fool. The reason why I say that, and I say that, is the Honourable Gentleman will know that I am not taken to use that sort of description. But when somebody says something which is foolish, and it is foolish to simply get up and make that sort of allegation, especially when it is untrue, I'm afraid there is only one description that applies. For example, in the same way as somebody who decides not to enter a contest because he feels he might lose, might be best described as a chicken.
Question number one. I think, you know, if I could remind or remember that the use of certain words in respect of the context is not really, because it is sometimes when people ask something to respect the word and the system.
Question number 156, the Honourable D. Jones Jr.
So this was a slight question. W from the 8th, 2020. Can the Minister have responsibility for the airport state when he expects a memorandum of understanding with Gibraltar Air Terminal Limited will be concluded and what this terms it will be expected to include? The Speaker, this is just on a point of order, if I may. This is further to an answer which the Honourable Gentleman passed on to me by way of written reply because he wasn't here at the last meeting of the House. But for the sake of the record, I'm not sure, I'm certain for those people watching and listening, I'm not sure how that works in terms of, so one, does I give the honourable member the opportunity to read out the reply to the question, and then we go on to supplementary, or stays on the record as it is?
The written question forms part of FunSound.
Perhaps I can clarify the question that I have that he's referring to is W28. W28 is a written question. It is not an oral question which was then handed over in written form. I have the question here, and it actually says written, unless the honourable member might disagree. But the one I've got is W28, which is written, unless this is one of the ones that I wasn't here to answer. If it is, then it became a written question.
Just to assist the gentleman to confirm the position, it was an oral question. I have ever filed a written question in my previous incarnation and two parliaments ago, or indeed in this one. So it was an oral question which was converted into a written question as a result of the honourable member's actions at the last meeting.
That is correct.
Because it's just that I saw written in the order paper, and I assumed that this was presented as a written question. But it is, as Mr. Speaker has indicated, it is part of the record of my program, one of the oral questions. I think I will answer together with question 157 of 2020.
Question number 157, the Honourable DJ Rafinian.
So this is a reply to question W28/2020. Can the Minister have responsibility for the airport? Is precisely how the recommendations of the principal auditor are set out in 3.13.1 and 2.13.3 to 2.13.6 have been taken into account and are being implemented.
Answer the Honourable Minister of Education, Employment, Utilities and the
Public. The recommendations of the principal auditor are set out in paragraph 3.13.1 and 3.13.6 have been taken into account and implemented as policy, and this also includes 3.13.2, which is the previous question. Paragraph 3.13.1 of the principal auditor's report is an introductory paragraph to the section on the delay issue, and it has no recommendation as such. Paragraph 3.13.2. The government's position in connection with the memorandum of understanding with Gibraltar Air Terminal Limited, or GATI, the same as stated in our question W28/2020. The matter is still at a discussion stage. Paragraph 3.13.3. The recommendations have been implemented as now the statements issued by the ground handler are reconciled monthly against copies of the ground handling agreement charge notes. This recommendation has been given effect as from 1st of April 2019. Paragraph 3.13.4. This relates to the level of detail of the reconciliation statement prepared by the contractor and the fact that these did not provide the necessary details to allow an effective monthly check against revenue received as well as the arrears of revenue. The ground handler now provides a statement which is broken down into the different headings the capital requires. Additionally, this is reconciled monthly. Paragraph 3.13.5. This relates to invoicing and more specifically to bear arrears of revenue and the fact that they did not provide GATA with an aged debtor analysis, so that the government was informed of outstanding revenues and could therefore include the amount due in government arrears of revenue figures. This has been remedied as all of GATA's arrears of revenue are now incorporated into GATA's arrears of revenue figures as submitted. Paragraph 3.1.3.6, this relates to the monitoring of controls over the receipt of aviation revenue and what measures should be implemented in order to ensure that the revenue received was complete and accurate. The recommendations of all ground handling agreement charges issued by the ground handler are now cross-reference with GATA receipts issued at the information desk as in fact been implemented.
Because there may not be an answer to the honourable member we have readily available to him, but in relation to those paragraphs, exactly right, the 13.1 is exactly paragraph 11 containing the recommendations, and I would hasten to add that some of the recommendations have been addressed on the body of the audited report. But I thought it was important to raise this issue publicly because I thought it was quite alarming that given that the effects of all the revenue streams of the government, that it would be important that the public understand that these issues have been addressed. But the question is this: can he state when these recommendations were given effect to and were implemented?
Just to clarify, this does not affect the government. Revenue stream. This is an accounting process. It is just clarity that was required. It has nothing to do with the actual money, as I understand what the perception of the litigation is in terms of reconciliation and the clarity and the detail that had to be provided by the ground handler to GATA and GATA in turn to the government. So it did not affect actual revenue stream, but it affects reconciliation and being able to have them be detailed to be able to carry out that reconciliation. The, in terms of the specific supplementary as to when they have been given effect, the information I have in relation to paragraph 3.1.3.3 is that this was done and was given not retrospective effect, but was given effect as from April 2018. In other words, the reconciliation that was required and was recommended was done backwards until the 1st of April 2018. I'm afraid I don't have the specific date for each of the other paragraphs, but I'm happy to obtain that information for the honourable member if he needs it. The only specific date I have is in relation to that particular paragraph, which is 3.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the first question in relation to this issue. Can he, this is a memorandum of understanding, which he says is still in the process of being discussed and the terms thereof. Can he give an indication, one, when he expects that the agreement will be ready and be able to be signed in the dotted line? And can he also confirm whether the terms of that agreement would include a specific recommendation contained in 13.2 of the auditor's report?
Speaking of the recommendation, is that there should be a memorandum of understanding between GATA outlining airport terminal fees and concessions revenue stream recipients. That is a matter that the Chief Secretary is handling directly with GATA, and there are ongoing discussions as to the putting together of a memorandum of understanding dealing with the city. I don't have specific information about the state of those discussions, except that the discussions are ongoing, following from the original question, which is that the answer that I gave the other member originally, and the position continues to be.
Question number 158, the Honourable DJ Rossini.
So this is a reply to question W27 of 2020. Can the Minister for the Port provide further details regarding the one proposal it is considering in connection with the provision of low cost hotel rooms for people?
arm for the world, and make it for education, employment, utility, and the port.
Mr. Speaker, the government is not in a position to provide further details at this juncture. As with all discussions in relation to proposals made to government, an announcement is made once the discussions are concluded.
Okay, can you give any indication as to whether the government's intention is to use the current sort of building stock in negotiations with the owners of the operate current hotels, or is it the intention to build a present built hotel in relation to this?
The negative
on the Arnavon member is very confident that the strategic propositions that I put to him are not being considered. And on that basis, can he provide me some information, as to what it is that he is looking at positively?
Well, what he has said is not being considered. The proposal that we are dealing with does not involve the issues that the honourable member has taken, but it is not my intention to give a running commentary as to where we are on this. The government has received a specific proposal which the government is not just considering, but engaged with the party giving the proposal. It is a commercial proposal, and until those discussions are concluded, as we have often and repeatedly stated, then no further details can be given.
Question number 159, the honourable chair of the
Mr. Speaker, does the government expect to continue to make an annual contribution of 1.5 million to the Gibraltar University, or are there expectations this might go up or be reduced?
Also, the honourable minister of education, employment, utility, and the port.
Mr. Speaker, the government contribution to the university for the financial year 2020-2021 has been considered in the context of the preparation of government's overall budget for the next financial year. The amount of the contribution will be announced at this year's budget.
Speaker, as the minister impacts the university in relation to the contribution issues and the degree of finance assistance that they require, then is our plan that the investment should be more self-funded so that we would have an impact on this contribution?
Mr. Speaker, not only are there plans for the university to be more self-funded, it is in fact a statutory obligation. It is in the University of Gibraltar Act. It is a specific provision of the Act the university should be towards that. Having said that, the university has been ongoing for several years. It is a relatively new university. This is one that has the full support of the government, and the government will continue to provide the funding that is required for the university to succeed and prosper, as we have always intended. And as regards the question, am I in touch with the university? Of course I'm in touch with the university on a constant basis. And the way, just by way of information, and the honourable member has been a member of government, so he knows how these things work in terms of budget and bids, each department or each area of responsibility for which the minister is responsible, puts in a bid, which is then collated and passed on to the financial secretary and chief medical office, and then considered in the round in the context of the overall bids that are made to the government from the different departments, and then a final decision is taken where that stays.
I think the funding budget is perfect, I think of that. But in the discussions, and as the honourable minister acknowledges, the university has an obligation to at some point get to self funding figure. And while there may be an annual budget in process, the university itself may not work that way in itself, in the sense that the university will, as I've some kind of 3 or 5 year projection of where it wants to go. In the context of that, has it shared with the minister some kind of time scale ambition of when it will get to a point where it will be self-funding, or where the contribution might be due? Maybe that's what I'm asking.
The university clearly has a strategic plan, a 5-year plan, but that is different from the preparation of a bid on a yearly basis. When you look at the budget for that particular year and what the university will need for that particular year, if the university makes a bid which the government has to consider in the context of this year's budget and what it will provide the university this year, the fact that the university may have planned for 4 or 5 years and to make particular levels will not necessarily assist in the assessment of what the university needs this year. The specific question is about the contribution that the government makes in respect of the university, and the specific amount of the research is one that was contributed to last year. The amount that will be contributed to, and I can definitely say there will certainly be a contribution from public funds to the university this year. The specific amount is what is currently under consideration.
Perhaps not the honourable members misunderstood my question, but I wasn't asking about the contribution for this coming financial year. My question is about, does the government expect to continue to make an annual contribution? It's more generic, really. That's why I'm asking, in phrasing, in relation to this, the possible objectives that the university might have on a 3 or 5 year basis, and trying to understand if the minister can even appear today to really share the expectations that there might be of the time scale of getting to a point where the university might be more self-funding, if not self-funding,
The hope, of course, is that the university will succeed, that there will be more students, there will be more fees paid to the university, and government contributions published from public funds will reduce. That is not just an aspiration or even a hope. It is, as I've already indicated, an obligation from the university to move towards that direction. I've also indicated that the university will be a relatively new institution, and certainly for the next year or two or perhaps three, I see that a public contribution will be required to the university, and government is committed to continue to fund the university because it is an institution that we are proud of and it's serving a magnificent purpose.
May I just remind all members to listen to standing order and rules governing rights to ask questions. And I refer specifically to standing order 17.1.4. A question shall not contain any argument, inference, imputation, or defense, or ironical expression. Might subject this to all of the defendants so that they are aware of the standing order. Thank you.
Question number 116, the Honourable Ms. T.B. Hassanon.
Education taken to ensure all schools teach every part of equality act for what children need with a proper understanding of the importance of equality and respect in this one.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the government does not understand which legislation the Honourable Member is referring to. The act which the Honourable Member cites is not part of the referral. Having said that, I can inform Honourable Members that the first pillar of the Department of Education's overarching vision focuses on educational equality. of young people to understand equality and know their rights, to understand how they should be treated and how they should treat others. Teaching these topics creates a safe place for students to explore, discuss, challenge, and form their own opinions and values. The knowledge and respect of rights that students gain from this, combined with understanding, respect, and tolerance for difference, can empower them to tackle prejudice, improve relationships, and make the most of their lives. In our ever more diverse and challenging society, it becomes more important to instill young people with these positive and open-minded attitudes. Teachers use inclusive language and are aware of potential bias within the learning environment. The acceptance of every person from every background is naturally important. Teachers strive to teach children to be open-minded. By being aware of signs of discrimination, teachers can work to create a learning environment that ensures a classroom of equality. In order to establish these aims, all schools have mission statements and policies that establish and promote an ethos which emphasizes the importance of equality and of respecting difference. All schools have a detailed PSAT curriculum and are currently using the program of study from the UK PSAT Association to update and renew the content and approach. The PSAT Association is at the forefront of research and development for personal and social education. Equality and respect are promoted throughout the program of study. PSAT themes include at primary level, how behavior affects others, being polite and respectful, caring for others' needs, what makes us unique, recognizing hurtful behavior, play and working cooperatively, sharing opinions, what makes a family, looking at diversity, recognizing respectful behavior, the importance of self-respect, rights, freedom, and responsibility, positive friendships, respecting differences and similarities, responding respectfully to a wide range of people, recognizing prejudice and discrimination, compassion towards others, workplace stereotypes, recognizing individuality and different qualities, relationships, civil partnerships and marriages, expressing opinions and respecting others' points of view, valuing diversity, challenging discrimination and stereotypes. At secondary level, diversity, prejudice and bullying, race, religion, gender, self-worth, equality of opportunities and careers, and life choices, discrimination and reform, gender identity and sexual orientation, healthy relationships, teamwork, mental health and ill health stigma, communities, belonging and challenging extremism, different families and parental responsibilities, personal values and communication, conflict resolution and relationship changes. This learning is reinforced in other areas of the curriculum through the choice of resources, displays, assemblies, and awareness raising days. More recently, teachers have taken opportunities to update their knowledge and skills in this area. Over 40 teachers, for example, attended the Mermaid Gender Awareness Training in November. Training has been attended by all teachers to raise awareness and reduce the stigma around mental health. Head teachers and teachers have also attended seminars and training on managing diversity and inclusion for the Disability Act, disability, language and etiquette, and numerous autism training sessions. The Ministry of Equality also works with schools to deliver issues around equality and respect. These include gender stereotypes, International Men's Day, respect and healthy relationships, and elimination of violence against women. And Mr. Peter, just as an aside and as an example of what goes in schools, there was a press release issued last week, which is how the Governor's Medal Lower Primary celebrates International Day of Women and Girls in Science. And this is a project where pupils of Governor's Medal researched, studied, and celebrated the significant work carried out by various female scientists in the past and present. And this is just a recent example of the way equality and diversity is promoted in our school.
For clarity's sake, the equality act that I was referring to was actually the Equal Opportunities Act, I believe it's 2006. But I was specifically referring to matters relating to LGBTQ plus issues, which have been addressed in PSAT, but I understand they haven't been fully addressed, and that it will be a requirement in the UK law from 2020. students have brought this up to me as something that needs addressing more substantively, and with also with regards to bullying in that area. There are currently safe spaces provided by volunteer teachers in both faith elements that just take time off from their lunch, from what I understand, to reassure the gender variant teachers in the school, but no formal training or support has been provided. So I appreciate the intention that the minister has expressed, but my question is, will there be formal framework in order for teachers to receive equality and diversity training to address these equality issues in a formal way, which isn't being done at the moment within the curriculum, also to ensure a safe and equal environment? It's not happening at the moment, which is why I'm asking the question if and when it will be.
I think it is quite extraordinary that the Honourable Member could say this is not happening. Have you not heard the answer that I have given? I have specifically referred to 40 teachers attending the Mermaid Gender Awareness Training. Also about secondary education, including lessons on diversity, prejudice, gender identity, and sexual orientation. Now, the Honourable Member says that what she meant in the question was about LGBT+. So she didn't say that in the question. She referred to the Equality Act, which I assume to know how do we deal with equality and respect in our curriculum. And that is what I addressed in the language. But to say that this is not happening is not correct. If the Honourable Member might be saying it's not happening enough, well, that's something that we might have to look at. But certainly, and the Honourable Member will know that the Ministry of Equality makes great strides and does work in cooperation with the Ministry for Education. We also work with you as well in relation to these matters. And this is entirely promoted and taught with a view to children expressing their own views and having discussions and promoting awareness and respect for equality. That is the ethos behind everything the school is about.
Mr. Speaker, LGBTQ issues come within the remit of what I've been asking, which is about children living with a proper understanding of what important and equality and respecting difference. Mermaid training is supposed to support gender dysphoria, not sexuality, and there's a big difference there. And I would urge the minister to ask many of the teachers who entertain these safe spaces if they feel that they have the adequate training and perhaps understand what exactly they need, because at the end of the day, what we want to do is make sure that we equip them with the right skills in order to do that. Guidelines, Mr. Speaker, is another question that I would ask the minister if he would be willing to set and ensure exist in the schools, because there are no clear guidelines for supporting trans and gender diverse children also and young people in our schools. These are things that I'm missing, Mr. Speaker, and I'm not making it up. I'm bringing to the table questions in good faith in order for the minister to be aware and perhaps set such guidelines and such training in a way that will reflect on the students who are also falling out for it, so that they can have a better understanding.
Speaker, I have no doubt the Honourable Member is raising these matters in good faith, and I haven't questioned that at all. It seems that she's suggesting that teachers are coming to her with those concerns. If teachers believe that there is something missing or that more should be done in a particular area, those concerns should be raised not to the opposition, but to help teachers and to the Department of Education. None of this has definitely come to me, but if the Honourable Member says that we should be looking at how we could further promote this area, well, this is something that is constantly looked at, in particular in discussion with the Ministry of Equality, who are very well versed in this area, and who the Honourable Member will know is that the strides that this government has made throughout the 8 years that we have been in office to promote gender awareness, to promote equality, to promote lack of prejudice in relation to sexuality. I don't believe that any government has done more than we have done in this area. So our record is unquestionable in this area. And yes, we will continue to improve. We will continue
one more question from Ms. Bell, I'm grateful for the answer. Will the trainings go as far as to train parents of children in the school in order for them to help children with their own issues and to teach their own children to behave and express themselves in a way that then fills out to the rest of the students in order to create a better synergy and understanding among all the students? I believe that parents should be enfranchised in the training, and I'm asking the minister if it's something that he would consider.
I think it's generally in the Department of Education, we're not in the habit of training parents on the campus. We train the children, and such training is provided to the teachers, so that the teachers can impart this to the children. But part of the training, and the fact that the Honourable Member is talking about is greater awareness of the issues and how to deal with these issues at the community level, rather than just in relation to the school. A lot of this education, a lot of this training, starts in school. Once children become aware of these issues, they themselves will take those issues home. And they will impart that lack of prejudice, that lack of bias, that respect for equality in wherever they are in their social environment, including at home. It happens on environmental matters, where a great deal of strides are made in relation to environmental awareness, the acronym for plastic. And we have the children then educating their parents and educating the wider community. And that is part of what we're doing in schools. So yes, it does turn out to the wider community. We don't give particular assessments to parents to come along to the school, but certainly to children, to then impact on their parents and on their kids and the wider community. These values which are certainly at the heart of all of us, I think for all of us in this parliament. And that we want to make sure that we continue to promote.
Mr. Speaker, that would be of any assistance to the Honourable Lady. Just to say that the youth service does a lot of work with LGBT plus Q people, because they also have asked me, through the voice of young people, if they could have spaces in the youth club. And I was just quite surprised, in a way, to see that they were asking a minister for space for people with gender issues or whatever. Because I said to them that you are free to have any space. And I looked at the youth service and they said, it's brilliant, excellent. The fact that they can now go to the youth club, they have their own space, they have their own time, they are discussing with parents and grown-ups about these issues. There is a lot of discussion within the youth service about LGBT plus. So yes, it is happening and it is coordinated together with the education department and together with the Ministry of Equality. So there's a lot going on that people need to understand that it is happening. And it takes time and it takes the society to get into their heads about the issues that they do encounter. And I think it's important that young people are coming out and they are getting the space that they need.
Next question. Question number 161, the Honourable Ms. Sandrine Lefanon.
The compulsory school aid in the UK
changed
from 15 to 16 in 1972. Thereafter, rules on work-based learning, part-time learning, mixed with voluntary or part-time work for full-time education apply until a child reaches the age of 18. Are there plans for the government of the Volta to legislate to bring up the compulsory school aid in line with the UK compulsory school aid?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Board.
Thank you. I'm just curious because I didn't put my chair. Mr. Speaker, thanks for the minister for his answer. Can you give us an indication of by when, more or less, they think it might be implemented?
Mr. Speaker, I would expect by the start of the next couple of years. Mr. Speaker, the old lady in the question asked that you say the school leaving age has been for 16 months onwards. But she has in a sentence there are some rooms and workplace learning and so on there. Does the minister have in mind that considering an introduction of so that specification of 24 cases is going to be simply adhered to? Child reaches the age of leaving the school and is going to consent to simply walk out of the school building and is left to his own devices thereafter. Speaker, it is obviously our intention then that our children should be as well equipped as possible when they leave the school environment, whatever it is that may be, whether it's 15, 16 or 18. And the older member will know the effort, and I have mentioned briefly in my answer the various changes that we have made this year, and the ongoing changes, the positive changes that we have introduced to education in the last few years. And one of the areas that we have introduced, that my colleague introduced last year when he was Minister for Education, was the vocational pathway in the school. That is not exactly the same as what happens in the UK, but it is a way of supporting children who reach a school age where they might be thinking of their future for the future and might be not as academically inclined as others may be. So this is a pathway which starts in conjunction with a normal academic group in the schools and can then lead, once they finish that, which they would finish at the age of 16, at the same time that they would finish their GCSE option, if they've chosen this vocational pathway, which would include MBQ levels 1 and 2, they can then proceed, if necessary, to carry on with MBQ level 3 in the same vocational pathway that they have chosen. We have already announced, and we've seen in fact in our manifesto, our plan for expansion of the areas that we will introduce as part of the vocational pathways, and we now have the facilities in the schools in order to be able to do this, particularly with the new facilities that we had a comprehensive. So this year, additional pathways will be rolled out, and we are in discussion with unions and with stakeholders, with Chamber of Commerce, and we're going to have a meeting of all relevant stakeholders to see how everyone, both from the point of view of the education department, the unions who look at worker issues and the business organizations can also put in a way which keeps children active and in a way following a pathway which will lead to a productive life. So we are moving in that direction. We're having discussions with all relevant people, but we've already implemented some of this in the school, and there's more to come this year.
Question number 162, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
I suspect that this question is going to be slightly redundant, given that we're actually just through the fifth and fourth, so far as I'm aware about. But I will ask you in any event, if you want to other interesting questions. How many parking tickets have been issued over the last 12 months, and how many have been paid?
I'm from the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Over the last 12 months, there have been 18,882 fixed penalty notices issued and
11,924
paid. Question number 100. Given the question, does the minister have any information on his note that's been prepared in relation to answer this question as to whether they are in relation to local registered vehicles or for those across the range then?
These are things that
Well, the total amount of parking tickets, I don't have information whether they're local or in France, but I'm thinking you can find out if you can find out if you can ask me next time or if I can write to you. Okay?
Question number 163, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
If the Canada government states how many tickets have been issued on the basis that the vehicle is derelict?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
If you can answer this question together with question 164.
Question number 164, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
If the Canada government says of those tickets issued on the basis of the vehicle is derelict, how many have been issued with derelict issued parking tickets previously?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
In both these questions, the Honourable Member has failed to provide a time frame for his request. I'm happy to try and furnish him with a ticket at the next meeting if he is more specific. I would also ask the question, I'd also confirm the ticket he's referring to, although we have assumed he meant parking tickets for the purposes of the answer I've provided.
I'm not assuming anything. I'm assuming that the ticket that has been issued for a derelict vehicle is only one type of ticket that can actually be reasonably issued by the relevant authority for the purpose of parking. The basis of my question was in relation to a number of vehicles that have been brought to my attention, whereby multiple tickets have been issued against the vehicle in order for the occupant himself to retain a spot within the parking bed. These individuals that we've known extend the time of their notice to get to release the MOT investigation of the conduction of these types of vehicles, and we constantly replace them. So in other words, maintaining a spot within the parking bed, which I'm sure the Honourable Minister is familiar with, I've practically sort of all discouraged actively in this time. And that was the nature of the type of question I was getting at. But I'm quite happy to ask a further question about that and give the Honourable Gentleman a time frame. But surely the Minister would have some useful information that would identify those offenders who have had their notice issued on a multiple basis or on a singular basis.
I'm not really aware of so many cases of this happening, but as I said, I'm not really aware of exactly how often this happens. But I've heard of certain cases, I've heard of certain cases. I've also seen this on social media, but I'll tell you one thing, when I go back to Monday and try and make sure that I've got to find out how it has been brought to our human ministry, if it's been brought, if anybody has complained about this or brought this forward to the ministry.
The right is directed, of course, by the strategic plan implemented by the government. And so far, clearing out parking spaces so people can actually park their cars. If there are those within our community that do not respect that, and use mechanisms within the law to curve around it so that they can continue to use these parking spaces constantly to avoid other things, and allow other members of our community to enjoy these parking spaces, I think that should be something that we should all condemn effectively, so that people can use parking spaces freely without knowing that they're being obstructed.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I'll be wanting a project very soon that will help the moving on these various vehicles. I mean, rightly say that, it's basically for parking for our people and not for people who just want to take advantage of the situation.
Question number 165, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
The Canada government states how many derelict vehicles have been removed in the last 12 months.
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
that 149 vehicles have been removed for the 20 years in the last 10 years.
This is clearly evidence of a problem that we have in our community in relation to derelict vehicles in the youth. Almost a mystery of parking spaces within our community. Insofar as the derelict vehicles are concerned, what is the process that follows after? I appreciate it's not on the order paper, but does the Minister know what we actually do, or what the relevant authorities do with these derelict vehicles once they've removed them from those spaces?
That's one thing I haven't found out yet. There was.
Question number 166, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Did the Canberra state how many vehicles have been subjected to emission tests in the last 12 months?
I said the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Speaker, 11,545 vehicles were subjected to emission tests in the last 12 months as part of the roadworthiness test.
Question number 167, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, can you confirm the position on the creation of segregated cycle lanes and unique cycle corridors?
I should be able to be the Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Speaker, as for the government's manifesto commitment, we are continuing our work to create segregated cycle lanes where physically possible.
Segregated cycle lanes need to be truly meaningful and safe. Plan carefully so that as to correct areas of importance to cyclists, we can create cycling corridors. We've also planned and left ample space to hurriedly and impulsively implement them. Implementing short distances of lanes may be of little use and may often be more dangerous than not having these lanes at all. The government is therefore working to develop a credible and comprehensive plan that will secure the safety of cyclists, reduce pollution and improve quality of life as a key plank of our green Gibraltar strategy and our desire to build a clean, child-friendly city in Gibraltar. I'm grateful to the Minister for his response in relation, and I agree, in fact, that short distance lanes are clearly dangerous to members of the community. I would also agree that you have to create something that is truly meaningful insofar as your transport policy is concerned. With that, having said all of that and the conclusions that he's drawn in respect of that response, would you now agree with me that the demarcation in areas where there have been short distance lanes for cycles has been unsuccessful in our community, and given the fact that they, he either alludes, may well be dangerous for our community, that they would revoke that policy in relation to the current cycle lanes that have been introduced in the project?
I don't think that the cycle lanes have been unsuccessful. If I'm not mistaken, there is only one cycle lane. Okay? Yeah. There's only one cycle lane, so it's never been many cycle lanes that have been successful. There's only been. Okay? No, but it's not in my case, it's just not there. Well, I'm told by my honourable friend and colleague, the Minister of Transport, that I thought there was only one demarcated cycle lane, which is the one in Main Street, but he says that there was another one on the runway. The one on the runway is frequently used, and I think it's extremely successful. The one on Main Street, but the one on Main Street is different because it's only it's on certain hours, and I think because it's on a pedestrianized street, then perhaps it's something that it's not been successful. It was a pilot project, and pilot projects are there for us to be at the end of the day to see how successful or not. I think it's a start, and insofar as what is coming. I mean, I'm looking at three new areas for cycling lanes, but these are three long areas. And I think they have to be carefully devised to make this small. We're not a major city where, huge
far off, so we need to be very careful in how we plan this. But the government's committed to cycle links, it's in our manifesto. And definitely going to go in this because I'm seeing on Zoom. So, like I said, I've got three specific areas, and you'll hear about them in the near future.
I'm grateful for that response, and I'm not trying to make a political point out of it. What I'm suggesting, given the natural conclusions that you have, the Ministry of Minister has made in relation to these points, that the pilot example that was given as far as Main Street is concerned, and although we may differ in opinions as to the success of that pilot project, it is clear by a number of observations that we received in our news, not just via social media feed, but it is clearly, in my perspective, dangerous, and therefore will the government commit to withdrawing that pilot project to enable it to really focus on, as we've now announced, three specific areas which will improve the ability of our community and those limited mechanisms to cycle into both in an appropriate way. And I commend them insofar as the initiative that we will bring to introduce the free cycle lanes, but insofar as that pilot project, as far as I know, it's still in operation, but if it is still in operation, I would ask them whether the government will abandon it at this stage and focus on better transport policies in relation to cycle lanes.
Yeah, the government will put in place to look into that, but with no specific commitment to abandon the point in time. Just for my information, Main Street is not a cycle lane. It started off as being a cycle lane, but after that, it became a shared space, a shared use space. The problem with having a bicycle link of space is a good cycle to the idea of. And this is my space, and anyone across to my space, I'll tell them off. Now, that is a very good pedestrian area, and the pedestrian always comes first. So, the idea was, this is why the actual lane is very marking that it is. And I think it's become a surface. The only thing that now is days, and after 7 o'clock at night, before 9:30 in the morning, at which time, the individuals are passing through there anyway. So I'm thinking right near the happening, traffic can go in a certain direction and keep the flow of traffic. So but in going on two moment time, that is if people are cycling in one way at other times for a day, whether you have an allowance for cyclists or not, that's anything about it that happened before and it always will happen if the connection is in place. But that has mentioned is not cycling, it's the area where cyclists can be. Always expecting the person's comfort in the given direction and always in the technology of it.
Given what the current Minister of Transport has said in relation to short distances, and Minister is a relatively short distance in my view, but as for the pilot project, I'm sure the Minister and both Ministers in their respective times have received information from the general public as to the efficacy of this particular lane. And given the markings are poorly worn away over time as well, and given Main Street is effectively for public to use up and down, would it not make sense to allow that to be scrapped at this stage, insofar as public health and safety is concerned, with a view of taking a more holistic approach as to how we recycle bicycles in our community? I would encourage him to assist me in the answer to this question because I think it's an important one. I agree with him in terms of cycling generally, but I think he's improved the quality of it. But what I would say is that pilot study itself has not been a success, and we should now look at ways. I'm not criticizing, but it's fine. The pilot didn't work, that's great. But insofar as the public health and safety of our community, we should now look at ways of abandoning that and moving to a more consistent and sustainable cycling policy.
First of all, I don't agree that it hasn't been a success. That's your view, and in terms of the others, I think it's been testing. I think it's still people are still using that cycling lane. So people are using it, but it's a success. Whether that's a success or whether we would have wanted it to be, we don't know yet. But maybe when we actually have a cycling lane, then we might take stock of the situation and and decide whether we want to keep it or not. But at this moment in time, we have no plans of abandoning it. Mr. Speaker, it is therefore the government's view, taking all of that into consideration, is it their view that the current arrangement is so far as sightseeing on Main Street is safe for the public? It's as safe as everything else is safe. It's not unsafe. As it is as safe as it is safe to drive or anywhere else, and we're not going to be suffering technically.
Mr. Speaker, the difficult law gentleman is to take short to talk about the law, and if this case has been a factor to say that's not a short lane, when we look about the effect of short lane, what is meant is very short stretches where there's a factor in place, whereby every time a factor can come back onto the main road, flashing back for oncoming vehicles. Those type of lanes are single changes. If you want to extend the lanes and look at Main Street, it extends all the way up Main Street down to town. It's probably the size of the data. It's probably around 1 kilometer of type of lane with 5 teams that we have at the airport. If you look at the airport, what happens is once it's in the airport, you have to come back onto the main road. So that is what you have to judge, you know, whether stretches, small stretches are. So that's the funding that the minister will have to look at and the ministers and keep in place after the session and then come into the zone and continue the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wanted to thank the former minister for transport for his clarification that the shared space, I think, is referring to Main Street and Irish South, that the priority should lie with the pedestrian. And encourage the government to ask its press office to remind cyclists and pedestrians alike that the priority does lie with pedestrians, because the government wants to gather evidence on the succession of Ireland and many members of the family and persons testifying that we have been victims to injuries by cyclists on both Main Street and Irish Side during unauthorized hours, and the reducing unauthorized hours will certainly think that they are a criminal road and that the pedestrian does not own. But the pedestrian does not have a priority. So I say that we're down in place.
Question number 168, the Honourable Dean Jason.
If the Canada government confirmed they have completed their review of Indonesia's political initiatives and the state, and sets the conclusion reached.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Yeah, I'll answer this question together with question 169.
Question 169, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government say how many complaints have been received by the relevant authorities insofar as the use of e-food is a concern?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to question 168, governments have now reviewed the feedback received throughout the consultation exercise, and based on assessment of that feedback, is aiming to publish legal instruments hoping to control and regulate personal rights electric transporters. In answer to question 169, Mr. Speaker, with respect to complaints, the Ministry has not to my knowledge received any direct complaints in particular regard to the use of these cases. People sometimes are more forthcoming on social media than they are in the process of filing direct complaints.
To clarify, the government has not received complaints. I did ask for the relevant authorities so that would have been the enforcement, police, customs, borders, any relevant authority that would have received a filing to the government. But I assume the answer to the question is zero, no official complaints have been received.
Yes, you know, I mean, I honestly have not received any sort of specific complaint, and then being brought to my attention.
Just one further question. When does the government propose to bring regulations or promote regulations in relation to the regulation of these people?
It will come to me in the next couple of weeks. And hopefully, I'll be able to bring the bill to Parliament by the end of
bringing regulations rather than bringing timely legislation to the town. So, it's been prepared as a final draft will be sent to the next week or so. I'll be able to give you more information then. And then, what I was getting at is, will the government be legislating by way of regulation, or will the minister be bringing a bill to the House for regulation of institutions?
Question number 117, the Honourable Ethan Phillips.
Can the government state how many four-wheeled vehicles and motorcycles are registered in Gibraltar as of Friday the 7th of February 2020?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
I'll answer this question today with question 171.
Question number 171, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
If the Canada government state of all the registered vehicles, how many are hybrid or electricity run?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
In answer to question 170, the total amount of registered vehicles in Gibraltar as of Friday the 7th of February 2020 for four new active vehicles and motorcycles is 43,929. Of these vehicles, in answer to question 171, the total number of registered hybrid or electric are 497. Is it just the Honourable Minister have a breakdown between the number of forward vehicles and motorcycles? Just that you gave me a total, the Minister has given me the total amount, but whether he has the breakdown on his script. The Honourable asked for how many four-wheel vehicles and motorcycles were registered in the national breakdown.
Question number 172, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Just one supplementary question. Given the commitment of the government in the last parliament to the ambitious one, I think it's the correct one, to promote the use of hybrid and electric run vehicles, is the government disappointed by the numbers of registered vehicles that are hybrid and electricity run at the moment? Because it would appear that you may well be long off that target, which I know it's a target, but one which I agree with, but what is the government going to be doing about improving communication within the public as to the purchase of these types of vehicles going forward? Because we don't really have that much time really left on the tick. I think it's 2035 when the minister said in relation to hybrid and 2040, if I'm not mistaken, in relation to full electric vehicles. I mean, the minister will obviously be aware that the last committee has also brought back. They're struggling with this to map out, I believe that is correct. The people are going to be committed to promoting the hybrid or electric vehicles. I think that at the moment we're in sort of an early stage of the development of this product. And as time goes by, I think people will realize when the new products on the market that going electric is the right way. It's a question of time. And perhaps a little bit of patience because people start realizing that driving an electric vehicle is much better than driving a petrol or diesel one. But it's pretty early days. And as time goes by, I think, and the product becomes developed, we will see more electric vehicles on the road. And the government, like I said, will keep on promoting that. I'm looking at perhaps doing some kind of promotion drive and getting people sort of acquainted to the idea.
Question number 172, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
This is the publication of the Sustainable Traffic Transport and Parking Plan. What has the government done to introduce the recommendations made therein?
I am for the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Mr. Speaker. Our government has been diligent in the implementation of the recommendations of the Sustainable Traffic Transport and Parking Plan. As far back as 2017, we were considered one of the first initiatives following the launch of the Sustainable Traffic Transport and Parking Plan. The highly anticipated speed cameras. The speed cameras follow previous speed management measures by way of introduction of solar powered electronic speed display signs. In April of 2017, the final route, Night Bus Route N8, was launched, completing the Devoted Bus Tracker Web App platform. This, Mr. Speaker, was, as the Honourable Members will appreciate, the first ever service offering bus users real time bus information. Then, Mr. Speaker, in May, a traffic light control crossing by Ocean View was implemented along with a number of speed calming measures in the area. Also in May, and the following consultation with the RGB, legislative changes were introduced to the Traffic Act 2005 to include new traffic offences. The Ready Bike Bicycle High Sharing Scheme was also introduced in May as a means of offering alternative sustainable modes of transport to commuters. The same month, Mr. Speaker, the first private residential parking zone, Zone 1, was launched. A festival time, Mr. Speaker. Following the extensive and thorough research that took into account the valuable stakeholder feedback received during the preparation of the STPPP. In fact, and should I add, Mr. Speaker, unlike the North District residential parking zones that were launched by the Honourable Members' Government, that did not properly take into account the proper needs of residents of these areas. To finish the month of May 2017, Mr. Speaker, the completion of improvements to Governor's Street was announced. As part of the STPPP's vision statement to promote sustainable modes of travel, such as walking, by enhancing pedestrian routes, which minimize to some extent adverse effects on our environment. Another recommendation, Mr. Speaker, was the implementation of pay and display areas to provide short-term parking and vehicular turnaround of locations known to be heavily frequented. Mr. Speaker, the new hours for commercial vehicle access into Main Street and neighboring pedestrianized areas was another measure introduced under the umbrella of the STPPP. This initiative was done in conjunction with the introduction of commercial loading and loading hubs to enable 24/7 access. To enhance the public bus route service and in keeping with the recommendations of the STPPP, request bus stops were also introduced. This initiative moved away from the previous practice where the bus was stopped at all bus stops irrespective of whether there were passengers wishing to alight, thus often resulting in unnecessary delays. Again, Mr. Speaker, and as part of the continued workings and implementation of recommendations in the plan, a speed limit review of local road was announced with changes to speed limits carried out. Some more traffic and pedestrian improvements were announced in September 2017, by way of two new zebra crossings at different locations, Europa Road and Rosa Road. More promotion, Mr. Speaker, of sustainable modes of travel, such as walking and enhancing and providing safer traffic for pedestrians. Pedestrian signage improvements were further implemented during November 2017, with signage improvements along the area of Waterfoot Road. Improvements, Mr. Speaker, to of course continue to promote and encourage walking. As part of the continued motion stages of the STPPP, short-stay parking bays were implemented in Zone 1 at the start of 2018. In continuing the rollout of residential parking schemes, January 2018 saw another STPPP scheme with implementation of Zone 2, a residential parking zone, Mr. Speaker, that as the Honourable Member will appreciate includes thorough consideration and challenges due to the limited on-street parking spaces available, by contrast to the number of unique addresses in the area. The first official electric vehicle charging points were introduced at Midtown Car Park in keeping with the STPPP. A massive damage of the initiative, Mr. Speaker, that was also consistent with the Department of Environment's thinking the environmental awareness campaign. An example, Mr. Speaker, of ministries working in unison towards a common goal. At the start of the summer season, residential parking scheme Zone 3 was rolled out. Yet another step in the parking zone of residential districts in Gibraltar, providing residents of that area with improved chance of parking while still supporting the business and commercial activity in the area. The
In parallel with the launching of the zone, the government was also listening to feedback from stakeholders and announced changes to two zones, one and two, to continue to improve the system and increase the effectiveness and success of the scheme. Following the successful launch of the first phase of the speed tunnel, the Navajo government of Bogota is pleased to announce the second phase of this project in June of 2018. This included the introduction of two further speed, 6 feet tunnel sites along Queensway and Waterport Wharf Road. With the new school in 2018 came the early anticipated new school bus service. With bus departed from the south to the schools, exclusively for the use of school children, and a hope that it would result in fewer conflicts, leading to less congestion and contributing to reducing the carbon emissions. 2018 came to an end with the revision of the Gibraltar Blue Badge scheme to include a number of initiatives to enhance the system for users. This came as a result of the perceived abuse and inconsiderate use of the base. The pilot scheme would also see the introduction of new restricted disabled parking bays throughout Gibraltar to allow improved parking opportunities for youth. We started 2019 with a series of improvements to pedestrian safety and options in the area of Market Road, Pearl Road, and Glasses Road. This included a new crossing on the Smith-Dorian Bridge, more motorcycle parking, and a relocation of a loading bay to a more suitable and safer location. Later in the night, attention turned to the bus stop enhancement when the launch of new bus stop flagpole signage began in phases. These signs are designed to be more user-friendly and add to a new branding that was taking shape of the Gibraltar Bus Company, following on from the new logo representing public transport in Gibraltar. Other improvements are also included in a new bus network map, which is easier to read for visitors and locals alike. Further recommendations focus on major resurfacing works of Queensland and the promotion of cycling in Gibraltar, an excellent and healthy activity as a mode of transport. Enhancements such as more bicycle racks in key areas like Airport, Harbour View, Little Bay, Old Parade, and the new comprehensive schools at Waterport. Indeed, even in the last 2 months that have passed of this year, we have taken to additional action in the direction of a new school bus service, Route S2, which was announced in the press release 1 of 2020. The service has been widely welcomed and well received by much of the rest of the implementation of the groundbreaking STT system. Mr. Speaker, I should add that a lot of what I have said, if not all of it, is publicly available information. Information one would expect the Honourable Member to be acquainted with in his capacity as Shadow Minister. Speaker, as much as I'd like to raise to the base one in relation to more specific parking schemes, I mean the last sentence was very full answer to the question. Of course, what we'll be doing now is analysing evidence there and come back with further questions in relation to the government's transport policy. But what I would ask him to confirm is that this policy is a living document, i.e., it can change in representation, so we alluded to that in relation to the South District Parking Schemes. We've also conceded, I think, a sensible measure that the cycle lane issue that we've had this afternoon, I don't want to bring that up again, but this is a living document, the SCCP, in that we will receive constructive comments from the opposition and indeed members of the public as to how it works in practice. But I would ask him to clarify that it is a separate document rather than a fixed piece of work that the government commissioned.
I don't get the question.
It's probably clear, but anyway, I'll repeat it for the benefit of the minister himself. I'm asking him whether he considers this to be a living document, or rather a fixed document as far as the government policy in relation to transport is concerned. I hope that is easier to understand.
This is a living document. We're working with it all the time. We've done a lot over the last 3 years, and we'll continue improving on a lot of the stuff that is in that document.
Thank
Question number 173, the Honourable G. Davis.
Can the Minister for Tourism provide details of the Tower Road shows announced by his department recently to London, Manchester and Bristol, include the cost to the government and entities which participated?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Mr. Speaker, as outlined in question 69 of 2020, the Gibraltar Tourist Board hosted three solitary roadshows in the UK on the 4th, 5th and 6th February in the London area, Manchester and Bristol. These events are aimed at the solitary in the UK. Agents were invited to engage with representatives of the tourism industry from Gibraltar and UK operators featuring the rock along with retailers and visitors. There were a series of business-to-business opportunities and destination presentations where UK travel agents were updated on all that Gibraltar store facilities. The chief executive of the BTB delivered destination presentations at all three venues. Co-exhibiting with the BTB were Turtle Holidays, Dan Marvel, Emmett Blank, Sam Bond, Walter, Dive Charters, Chris Airways, EasyJet, Fred Holidays, and Enable Holidays. There was no cost for these exhibitors, except for their own travel and accommodation costs to attend these events. I, as Minister for Tourism, attended the first of roadshows in the London area. Hundreds of travel agents in total attend the roadshows, and there are people who directly spend holidays to consumers in their outlets on a daily basis. Information requested by the gentleman in respect of cost is provided in the schedule I now hand over. There should be no doubt, Mr. Speaker, looking at the cost involved, that the value for money being achieved by this event is excellent and shows that the government is listening to the industry and delivering. If I were to divide the total cost of the event per agent, bearing in mind that the cost also covers expensive B2B and hospitality and exhibition charges for the current business, the government has spent just over £190 per agent in these events. Imagine, Mr. Speaker, if just a fraction of these sold one holiday to Gibraltar and the next. The next day. How this has multiplied into the economy and the value we have delivered. Is that the Minister saying the sold and excited about this project? Can you advise whether he intends to do more of these and does he have a structure and a plan in place going forward in the next, long term?
I'm bold and excited about every project that I undertake. Mr. Speaker, of course I have a plan to on how we're going to carry out. First of all, it's excellent value for money. If you see the total amount that was spent, which is just under £21,000 for three roadshows. It's approximately £7,000 each. I was present at the London show, and the amount of interest that Gibraltar has is quite amazing. The agents that are there, they're truly supportive of Gibraltar and very keen supporters of Gibraltar's program. So I think the idea of having these roadshows is might be an excellent one. And one that the government will continue to pursue.
So, Mr. Speaker, you don't need to be concerned about my question about costs. In fact, on the face of it, doesn't look like that much, to be honest. Given that we're talking about universal things in effect. So I'm not targeting him in relation to that point. So, can rest assured that he's calm about that. It's really whether he has expressed a desire to continue with this plan, but does he have at this stage a specific structure in place? In other words, what I'm getting at is he planning to go to other cities maybe next year or the end of this year? Which cities? Do you have that information? The great thing you can provide us with that information, or is it the same cities? Because he's seen that there's a success. It's that type of structure which I'm quizzing him about.
Mr. Speaker, the government will be holding a roadshow in Edinburgh on the 3rd of March. Of course, we've had it in getting there with the launch of the new area. That is the first step of what we have planned at the moment. And the way the tourist board works is that they tend to have the annual roadshow in London, in Bristol, and Manchester, obviously because of the direct elements that we have with these three cities. And the reason why we're having the first ever roadshow in Edinburgh is because we're making the
news. Just one final question. In the view of the interview that's been taken from his, the question that he referred to in his initial reply, but it's reported in the Gibraltar Times as well, and I'm quoting from that particular news outlet, where it talks about, he's quoted, I think, in our news, little white campaign entitled Time to Be Enlightened, developed by our media buyers and their design team. Can you provide details of what the media buyers and our design team is?
Mr. Speaker, a lot of this work has come through our London office, so I'd have to find out who the exact company that was involved in this.
Mr. Speaker, the cost in relation to that specific item is that the type of thing? Because the answer is no. I just want to look like the honourable member to confirm that position.
Correct, it's not included in the answer, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 174, the Honourable Dean Jameson.
Can the Minister for Small Businesses provide further details regarding the government's participation in the bid task force to include the agencies involved?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
I'll answer this question together with question 175.
Question number 175, the Honourable Dean Jameson.
Can the Minister for Small Businesses state what the expected financial contribution of the government to the big scale scheme that will be?
Also, the Honourable Minister for Business, Tourism and Transport.
Mr. Speaker, can I answer the question 174? As the Honourable Member may be aware, a press release was published on the 30th of January 2020. Setting out that the work continues on the Ministry's Business Improvement District. At present, our Ministry continues in discussions with the GFSB and the Mosaic Partnership and is working on preparing the necessary legislative framework. In answer to question 175, as the Honourable Member will appreciate, the Government is committed to supporting the bid proposal on a pound-for-pound basis. The commitment, as I'm sure you will be aware. The expected final contribution will be determined once the size of the district is determined and the levies payable have been calculated. Once again, Mr. Speaker, the Mosaic Partnership are currently actively working with the company on the bid proposal.
Speaker, some specific questions arise from that, as you have seen the questions we can. The questions, again, I don't have it in front of me, but I do have it in front of a press report, which presumably has given the information from the press release that the Honourable Gentleman of the Department issued. And it talks about 18 local businesses and government agencies that form part of the bid task force. Can you be more specific as to which government agencies these are?
Speaker, this task group is not formed by the government, is not formed by this. This is a task group that is formed by the Mosaic, by the company who's doing carrying out this project, Mosaic Partnership, and the GFSB. They've asked the government for assistance in matters to do with legislation, and my ministry are present in trying to assist them in trying to sort themselves out.
Maybe that's an official as a gentleman. If we say in terms of the government side, the participation from the government side is limited to his department, is that correct?
At the moment, what is what we need to do first of all, what the bid needs to do first of all is the legislation. So they after had a meeting with them today, and one of the first things that I wanted to know from them was how we could move with the legislation, because until the legislation is not in place, there's not much that can be done. They, that's why they need to vote, they also need to vote the city, because if the citizens don't want it, that's where the matter ends. So it's a bit of a catch-22 situation. We as the government were happy to proceed with putting the legislation in place in the way that they wanted to. But their own members might vote this down. So until they don't decide what they want to do, we can't really proceed. What I'm doing is trying to assist them in moving this forward, because I'm keen on seeing improvement from the ministry. And that is my participation and the participation of the government.
Speaker, because we have a press report suggesting it may be a minor point, just about just wanting to understand on the government side what their level of participation is and what is the press report. I'm assuming the from what you said earlier, the government in press release, but I don't have it in front of me, talks about involvement from government agencies in the school. All I'm asking the honourable member is to elucidate upon that, and I think that the honourable member for the environment wants to buck in and participate in answering the question. So maybe you can elucidate and provide a sense of that answer in a clear and succinct way. We are not thinking of backing in, maybe to assist in the sense that because some of the activities of the group is, as my honourable friend says, it's well to do and it's successful, will be the holding of events in the group. And I'm responsible for cultural events, therefore we are involved in supporting in that way. It's not backing in at all, it's assisting and providing information. I mean, in the reply, not necessarily in the process. And Speaker, the honourable member talks about the legislation. Can you be a bit more specific in relation to that? What is it that is specifically being considered? With regards to the meeting, which I think you said we've had today with the various stakeholders, and I'd be interested to learn what it is that the government, presumably by the Mazarin group, is being asked to do on that
account. Mr. Speaker, the main part of this legislation is how the money is being collected. Because at the end of the day, we are going to be paying half of that, and the rest of the traders will be paying their share. So we have to see how the money is being collected. That's one of the most important thing that we have to look at. The idea at this stage is for it to be collected as rates, as part of the rates. So that's one of the things that is being considered. And like I say, we are open to suggestions either from the Mosaic Partnership and the GFC. This is not our idea or plan or anything. This is the plan that they've wanted to do. They have come to us, and government is willing to support it. And if they're willing to be supportive of anything else that might be good for us.
I think that the honourable member is quite respectful and gentle about it all. I'm just trying to elicit some information. No, I haven't finished any of the supplementary. He talks about the main points that he's being considered. And he talks about the suggestions which are being put to him, quite rightly, by the Mazarin. All I'm asking him to provide, if he doesn't have the information in front of him, that's fine. And I can ask him next month, or he can provide it to me on another occasion. All I'm asking him is whether he can advise the House, by way of reply to my question, what areas of legislation they're looking at. He talks about the main points dealing with the collection of money. Are we looking, for example, if I can assist him, to some reform of the Fair Trading Act, for example, or the licensing legislation, and matters like that? It's a very simple question, and doesn't need to be defensive about the answer. I just want an answer.
Yeah, I think the member doesn't know what he's talking about. The only thing he knows about Main Street when he walks down it, because that's what I can think of it. I haven't got a clue about Main Street, and I'm not being touchy. I tell you, honourable member. That's right. Mr. Speaker, the Fair Trading Act is something that's totally separate. It has nothing to do with this legislation on the books.
And being a lawyer, you know that that is a separate act. It has nothing to do with this new legislation. This is going to be a new legislation. It's not going to be able to put it together with a fair trading act. It has nothing to do. The fair trading act has nothing to do with Main Street on its own. So really, you're not assisting me in any way. Well, to ensure that none of us get any more touchy than it appears, some think that we are, and others have suggested that they are, I would propose that we come back tomorrow, touchy or otherwise, at 3 p.m. to continue the questions. I now propose a question, which is that this House will now adjourn to Thursday, the 20th of February, at 3 p.m. I now put the question, which is that this House is now adjourned to Thursday, 20th of February, at 3 p.m. Those in favour of the bill, the House is now adjourned to Thursday, 20th of February, at 3 p.m.